Welcome to The Changemakers, the podcast from Seven Hills, where we delve into the lessons from life in the lockdown, from those who are living it, learning from it, and leading organisations through it. Now, my guest today is Wayne Hemingway, and he famously founded Red or Dead with his then wife-to-be, Geraldine, in a move that, and I quote, shook the fashion industry to its core. And it even inspired his daughter to describe him as cool in a recent Sunday Times interview. Well, today, this cool cat sits at the helm of Hemingway Design and is working on a new initiative, the Good Business Festival, taking place in Liverpool later this year. In introducing Wayne, I can tell you that music is a metaphor that matters to him. Whether as a young child dressed as Elvis on Morecambe Pier, an epic record collection, or a stint on Celebrity Mastermind with a specialist subject of disco. So Wayne, if music and fashion were always the passion, name that tune.
Yeah, well, that I've still got a sore point about Celebrity Mastermind, and I wish you hadn't brought that up, because I came second in that series, the second highest score, and the guy who won it did The Life and Times of Michael Atherton, and there's only ever been one book about Michael Atherton, and yet the subject matter of disco is way, way bigger than the subject matter of, no matter how good he was as a Lancashire and England opening batsman and a very good commentator, you know, the life
it's fairly narrow.
It's very, very narrow.
It's very narrow.
You started this up on a very bad theme, actually.
But I saw you sidestep my homage to Barry Manilow there and introducing you, which, well, you know, I thought music and fashion, your passion.
Yeah, and one of my favourite tracks of all time is that song, but done. He did a Spanish version called El Copa.
And
it's so good. And you know, even though it's Barry Manilow and there's quite a bit of cheese in that, if you put El Copa on, even to a cool crowd, they'll dance to it.
Yeah. Now, we've got an El Fresco interview going on here, so apologies to guests if you hear a little bit of wind or even the odd dog that might be barking. But I think it's also part of the vibe, right? Music, outdoor, al fresco life, all of that, I think, is part of this. And actually, Wayne, you're very kindly going to put together a Spotify playlist for listeners, because one of the things I was reading about is your epic record collection. I mean, this really is a love, a passion in life, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the founding things in, you know, formative things in my life was, you know, my mum always listened to music, and that was always a case. And I was given a lot of freedom as a kid to go out. And my first concert that I went to on my own, my mum had taken me to all the concerts like Slade and Sweet, and she was into all that kind of stuff. And I was very young then, 10 or 11. But then I was 12. I'm pretty sure it was 12. It was 1973. 1973, I'm pretty sure. I went to see David Bowie on my own, or with an older mate at King George's Hall in Blackburn. And to see this, you know, to be able to see the Aladdin Sane tour as a young teenager in a household that had been brought up with sewing machines going, with music and fashion. And it was a turning point in my life. And I remember it. I remember that evening so much. And the next day, you know, I went out and had my hair, had a feather cut when I had hair, and you know, went to a shop in Blackburn called, in the Arndale, called Clobber, to buy a big pair of yellow high-waisted Bowie trousers. And I bought a tank top with Galen from Planet of the Apes on the front, embroidered onto it. And then that evening in the Blackburn Evening Telegraph, as it was called then, there was a call to ban David Bowie from Blackburn, because he'd been on stage in what was looked like a white nappy. You know, he's this thin white duke in nothing but a pair of white undies. And I just thought, yes, I want to be banned. And that kind of, as a teenager, I was just kind of a rebel, but not a rebel that took drugs or was, you know, doing, but just going out all the time.
And so these are the early formative thoughts, I guess, some years later would then inspire Red or Dead. I mean, was music part of the vibe in terms of your thoughts on fashion when Geraldine were creating it?
So we'd met in a disco in Angels in Burnley at a Northern Soul night. And I first spotted her on the dance floor as this amazingly dressed young woman. I think how old was she then? 18 or 19. And she'd made all her own clothes. And then we went down to London together, literally with no money. And the first thing that I did was form a band when I went to London. I'd always wanted to be in a band, and it was kind of a post-punk, funk-punk band. And it, as anybody knows who's ever been in a band, it costs money. And I kind of, stupidly at the time, but you're supposed to do that as a teenager, took the money from the rent tin that was kept on our mantelpiece and spent it on a saxophone in rehearsal studios, and we had no money. And so Gerardine said, right, okay, well, you're going to sell, we have to get some money together. So you're going to sell your old punk clothes and your old secondhand clothes, and I'll sell the clothes. Gerardine had always made clothes. That was her thing. She'd left school at 15, and she'd left school at 15 so she could buy fabric to make clothes to go out. And so she emptied her wardrobe. I emptied my wardrobe onto Camden Market. It was six. The rent was £6. We took over that, well, £6 on a Saturday, £6 on the Sunday. We took 300 odd quid that weekend. We learned so much about business. We'd come to London with £50 each in our pockets, and suddenly we had 300 quid, and that was just by selling things out of our wardrobe.
That was the first taste of being an entrepreneur. Tell us something about, one of the things I think a lot of people always want to know is, tell us a bit more about the name Red or Dead, in terms of actually how you came up with it, what you thought it was representing, what you want others to think when they think about it.
Yeah, so the first logo kind of sums it up, really, and it was a hammer and sickle, the Russian
Soviet Union, yeah,
Soviet Union hammer and sickle with a across the front of it, a bow and arrow, and a kind of a gazelle, and basically, you know, I've got a very unusual background, which all of a sudden I'm back in touch with my family after a long, long break. Which is, I'm half, in old money, Native American Indian, in modern terms, First Nation. So I'm part of the Kaunaki tribe. My father, it's crazy, but my father was heavyweight wrestling champion of the world called Billy Two Rivers. And so that we put that into the logo. But also there was a big movement. At the time when we started, the Cold War between Russia and America was going on, and there was a lot of young people marching through cities saying "better red than dead," which was a very provocative statement, because it was saying that you would prefer to side with the Russians than the Americans, who were perceived by young people as being the aggressors and maybe were going to cause a third world war. And so we were saying, "Stop the aggression, America. Better red than dead." So we took that kind of slogan and turned that into a company, really.
And did you feel that was there a political statement behind the brand, or was that just a cool name to sort of work with?
There was always a political statement behind, and a societal statement behind Red or Dead. Nearly everything that we did, we realized we wanted to be a designer label, but we also realized that we didn't want all the rubbish that went with that. We didn't want all the elitism, the one-upmanship. We wanted to be, we stated very early on that we wanted to be the world's first affordable designer label. So that drove us. And then from very early days, we would be designing clothes for Greenpeace. My favorite, when I look back on Red or Dead Collections, you know, we sold the business in late 90s, but when I look back and we've got these books written about Red or Dead, and I look back and I see some of the things that we did. You know, we were the first company to make collections in jail in the UK. Not we weren't in jail, but you know, using prisoners. And we made our workwear collection in Full Sutton Prison in York, and it was a workwear collection. And we, more than that as well, we were using hemp, which to make it, which was obviously from, you know, obviously derived from a similar plant to cannabis. And we were doing all of those things and doing them all for a political reason. And the tabloids hated us. You know, they were saying that some of the stories about us, we were smuggling cannabis on a roll into a prison, and they were camping outside our house. And then other collections, we did one collection, which was where we banned any French buyers. 20-odd% of our business was to France, and we banned any French buyers from coming to the catwalk show or buying the collection that season, because we were supporting Greenpeace and we had on our backdrop. And bear in mind that we were designers of the year, so we were on news at 10 or news at 9 as it was then, and we had non-N-O-N, which was what the Greenpeace sign that they were wrapping around the French embassy and everything, because the French were doing nuclear testing in an atoll in the South Pacific.
I remember it, yeah.
And so we would take risks, like 20-odd% of our business gone, but it built our reputation. And every time we did something like that, we took a stand, our brand would go up and our sales would go up, and we'd enter another market. So we knew that balance between living our values, but also making money from it.
Yeah, and it made people want to talk about it. It made you remarkable. People wanted to remark. And I think that in that, if I think about two things about your story, I think that kind of edge, that jeopardy was a big part of that experience. But I guess another thing that, you know, I always associate with you with is the idea of fairness. And I guess that brings us on to the new work that you're doing with Hemingway Design and the Good Business Festival in Liverpool, because I think that concept of fairness, that commitment to it, especially in this kind of COVID-19 era. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing this autumn in terms of the work you're doing with the city and the festival.
So the Good Business Festival came out of, there was this thing called the International Business Festival that took place in Liverpool. It was funded by George Osborne and part of the early Northern Powerhouse talk. And the three festivals took place. They were relatively unimpactful, I think, because they didn't have a sense of purpose and a real vision behind them. And then, so we won the bid to deliver a fourth. There was attractive money to deliver four festivals, and we won the bid to Hemingway Design, working with Culture Liverpool, won the bid to deliver the fourth one. And we did it by being completely kind of sweeping the International Business Festival to one side and saying, look, if we want to create a festival that was meaningful around the world, that could resonate and that was of the moment and of the future, it had to be around purpose and values. The Hemingway Design brand team, so we're a multidisciplinary design agency, so we'd been doing some pretty significant brand work for the likes of, well, Europe's largest student accommodation provider, St Modwen, and one of Britain's largest developers. Sorry, Unite Students were the student accommodation, and then St Modwen, one of Britain's largest developers. And all of it had been around, you know, not talking about logos, that comes at the end, but talking about purpose and values and societal benefit. So we knew that you know, even FTSE 100 companies were all talking about this, as you know.
Business is a force for good. The idea that they could contribute. Yeah.
So we thought there needed to be a world event for this. There were plenty of small events around the world, mostly preaching to the converted. And so we won the bid, came up with the Good Business Festival. We immediately got amazing traction because we set out with this vision of being this holy alliance of everybody who is in business, because everybody's on that journey, but not to just, we're going to, no matter where you were on the curve, you can talk at this event. But also, I think our vision about being as exciting as South by Southwest is for the entertainment.
So this is Austin, Texas. Yeah. So bringing that sort of pizzazz to Liverpool.
Yeah, but also making sure that we had the brevity of TEDx, that we had the modernity of the boiler room, which, you know, which brings clubs like Berghaum to your living room or to your bar, so that we could be cleverly digital all around the world, but have the outcomes or the supposed outcomes of something like Davos. So that, you know, literally that is ambition. That we were. It's not just an event in Liverpool. This is a world event.
It's a good mashup as well. Yeah, I mean, how's the virus changed your thinking? I mean, do you think that businesses are behaving? I mean, obviously it's a big generalisation, but to what degree are you seeing good, I suppose, in terms of the commercial response, the business response, as you look around in response to the virus?
Well, number one, the Good Business Festival was supposed to take place for 5 days in October, and we obviously, because of the virus, we've had to shift a big chunk of that into 2021, but still hold one big day on October the 8th. But it's amazing, since COVID has come along, it's been so much easier to talk to big brands around the world. Mm. People realise that this is a turning point. Whether, you know, one of the things that we'll discuss is, you know, how much will the world, you know, will this be a reset? Probably not as much as a lot of people are saying in the media, but there's going to be a degree of reset and an acceleration, and most importantly, an acceleration of things. For example, a lot of us have been saying for a long time that the high street businesses, we're never going to go back to the 80s of shop till you drop and everything had to change. Well, this, thankfully, and it's a difficult thing to say, but it's cleared the dead wood out quite, it's clearing the dead wood out quite quickly. And sometimes sometimes a hard pruning is good. And what it will create is opportunity. At the end, human beings are amazing. You know, we've never gone backwards as human beings. We'll have blips and you know, and we'll have natural disasters and wars, and they will rock us back, but we come back stronger. And I'm a great believer that this, we will come back stronger through this. We'll be more purposeful. We will get rid of the old guard, who are not moving forward, and it will accelerate all of that.
Yeah, and I suppose if you're lucky enough to be in employment, if you're able to sort of see yourself through this, then actually you might not want to go back to the way things were. But there's also going to need to be reinvention. And one of the things I was just thinking about was obviously Red or Dead came to pass in a period of quite significant downturn, recession, back in the 80s. If you were to sort of advise, you know, if you were starting again today and you're advising yourself, knowing what you knew then in terms of what you might be doing today, what's the lesson of recession for you in terms of how to work your way through it and how to come out of it successfully?
Well, I think that the main thing is, you know, is to understand your own purpose and what your own beliefs are. We've always known that. We've always known that, you know, you make enough money to make your life as comfortable as you need it to, as you need it to be, which doesn't mean that you need private jets and big yachts and stuff like that. You build a team around you of great people. You make sure that your ideas resonate. You test them out on people you trust, and you make sure that you're all the time looking at the world and not being enclosed in your own bubble. You know, great brands, they have people who care about what's going on outside of their. You know, if we could have just been a fashion company at Red or Dead, we didn't need to work with Greenpeace and think about the environment. We didn't need to think about retraining prisoners. But because that we were interested as people in that, I always believe that if you're going to have a business, the best business has always come out of somebody who's got passion about what they're doing. And they're living that passion and turning it into a business.
Passion, and I think also open-minded about the world around you and the opportunities. Now, moving on, I mean, I'm just thinking, I mean, as we're going through this interview, I can't help but think about family, mainly because we can hear them in the background. In terms of you as a family person, and, you know, how this, you know, living through a big moment of global crisis, in terms of what does that do to you? What does that do to Wayne as a person, as a father, a parent, a husband? How are you going through it all? What's the lessons you're learning about yourself?
Well, it's difficult, really, because, you know, we're lucky enough to have a lovely house that we built ourselves in a great location. And a lot of the family have come back to hanker down here.
How many have you got in there? I can hear them all behind us.
Well, there's three grandchildren, all our kids are grown up, so two of our four kids, their other halves, dogs. And they've all come back, partly because, you know, we've got one at-risk person, so we've had to really close down and went, you know, no out to shops or anything like that. But and it's difficult because in a situation like this, you know, we've got an at-risk person, one of my kids at-risk. You wouldn't know that they were ill, but they are properly at risk. So, you know, you bring them together to look after them, but then you've got a team of people who are your extended family who you work with, and then you've got things like the Good Business Festival and all the other work we do on urban design and coastal regeneration, where you care about all of these projects, and you've got to get the balance right. It'd be very easy to, you know, to go out, play in the garden with the grandkids, but then you're thinking about all the other people who rely on you, and so it's very hard getting that. It's really hard getting that balance right. But family's important, but also, you know, I'm not so narrow-minded to think that it's the only important thing. If you've got a business, you've got to be responsible for a lot of other people as well.
So that's responsibility. But I suppose the thing I'm asking is there anything in you that changes when you? I mean, a lot of people are feeling like this is quite a kind of transformational event in the way that they look at life, the way that they look at work, the way that they look at the world in which they're living in. Is there anything, do you think, that's changing in your own outlook as living through the virus?
I don't think we were talking about that as a family, and I don't think there is. You know, I think we've always had family values and making sure that you give because you can give time to your kids and works. You know, with our kids, we took them to trade shows all around the world. We took them out of school. With our grandkids, you know, I'll sit somebody on my knee while I'm typing, and I'll explain if I'm reading the paper, if I'm reading The Guardian or something, I'll pick out pictures. And even with a 2 or 3 year old, you can mix. If you're, it doesn't have to be that you that you compartmentalize everything. And I really do think that our family has worked, because we haven't done that. We have realized that we're a family unit, but we've also got interests, and we bring our family through those interests as well. And it's worked, and I think it'll work with the grandkids.
And very briefly, do you think it's unleashed any new creativity in terms of the way that you're approaching the world and work?
Well, we've all learned, obviously, all the obvious things like Zoom, and I think it has loosened up. You know, we will allow our no, it's not that we allow our staff. I think it's allowing everybody to be a bit more free, but things will go back to roughly the same, but with added benefits. I think I don't think it's going to be that we all suddenly want to work from home 4 days a week and go into the office 1 day a week. We might spend an extra day working from home, but it's not the shift that some people are thinking. But the shift will be significant.
So it's a significant shift, half a leap maybe in terms of the future. Wayne Hemingway, thank you very much for joining me on the Changemakers. Now, I love the philosophy of Hemingway Design, to create, to transform, because I think that really is what Changemakers is all about. And I guess if you have an eye on design for a fairer future, there was lots in that interview about the shake of things to come, and perhaps even the new lyrics for the lockdown, because we're looking forward to sharing that Spotify playlist with you to go along with this interview. And I also look forward to joining you on the next edition of the Changemakers. Join me then.